You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, November 14th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A global forum sponsored by the Arab Thought Foundation and Fortune magazine held earlier this week featured a unique dialogue between business people and security experts. The topic, the Arab countries, issues, answers, and opportunities. WPFW's Reem Khatouta met with Prince Bandar bin Khalid Al Faisal Al Saud, the co-founder and trustee of the Arab Thought Foundation. He summed up his reaction to the discussions of security measures and potential economic impact of a strike on Iraq.
Conflict and wars are extremely disruptive to the social structure and economic development of the Arab world. But we do have problems. 9/11 is a very clear indication of some of the problems we have in our part of the world that not only affects us, but has now affected parts of the world that are outside the Arabian Peninsula. In addition, the problems with the upcoming Iraqi confrontation, we're all hopeful that it would not amount to that, but it seems like there is a very strong resolution on behalf of the United States and a coalition it has put together from across the world. There has been a UN resolution with this respect. It was unanimous. And we are really hopeful that the Iraqi leadership will be able to help us help it avoid such a conflict. I mean, we need some help from the leadership in Iraq to do this. But war is disruptive. It harms business interests in the area. And a very important aspect of this is the outcome is not absolutely guaranteed or clear for us. The only thing we know people can control is when and how to start it. But what happens after the first shot is fired is difficult to predict. And if at all possible, we can avoid bloodshed and loss of innocent life. I think we all would like to strive to that.
Local analysts in the U.S. talk about religious prejudice and the fact that they needed to increase their defense portfolio, which was the easiest to manage, rather than to invest in local domestic economy that was having a lot of problems. So they chose the Arab world as an enemy.
I would be very careful such accusations. It's very easy for me to accuse someone. The fact is, it's very difficult to prove any of these accusations, and it does no one any help whatsoever. We, as the Arab Thought Foundation, are a pan-Arab organization. We're non-governmental and non-sectarian in the Arab world. We are multi-religious. There is a large percentage of Arab Jews, which compose the bulk of Israel, and not a lot of people know that. There's a lot of Arab Christians who live all across the world, and there's obviously the majority of Arab Muslims. We have been able to live with each other for the past 2,000-plus years as Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Obviously, Islam coming in 1,400 years ago. And it was never really a problem for us in our part of the world, and we learned to get along. There weren't any interfaith wars in the Middle East. It has never been documented. The only wars that have been documented are wars when people outside the area have come in, such as the Crusades. And at the very end, that failed with the realization that it wasn't a just cause. And keep in mind, even during those Crusades, the Arab Christians fought with the Arab Muslims against the Crusaders. So we have learned to live with each other. And I would caution anyone from using religion as a basis for conflict. Obviously, the Arab-Israeli conflict is a source of major tension in the Arab world. I think the Arabs have all come to unite and agree that they respect the right for Israel to exist. They came up with a proposal in Beirut in the last meetings of the Arab Council, and we're disappointed that that hasn't met with the enthusiasm we thought it would. So we're really hopeful that we can get over this. It's important for all of us to guarantee the rights of both Israelis and Palestinians. And if we could have that balance, I think it would remove a major, major source of contention in that part of the world.
Again, going back to the issue of the CEOs and all of them favoring non-war solution, when I ask them directly the question, why don't you leverage this knowledge to push for dialogue, they stepped back. I ask you, what is the Arab world's business weight on the equation, and how can we leverage it to enforce dialogue and diplomatic solutions as opposed to emotional uprising like the CEO just mentioned to me, which might lead to this war?
I think we do have a responsibility in our part of the world, and I will be the first to admit that the business community and all NGOs within the Arab world have failed to meet up to expectations. And unfortunately, we find that radical elements in our societies and in other societies are the ones who are most vocal at the moment. We're here to say that the silent majority are people who are very normal. They wake up every morning thinking of taking their children to school and would really like to secure a peaceful and a life that's full of dignity. And if we can all focus on that, I think we'll be better able to understand. Unfortunately, if we have leaderships such as the Iraqi leadership, it makes it very difficult for all of us. I mean, you have to keep in mind that the Iraqi leadership's first crimes are upon their own people. And that makes our position in the Arab world very compromised. I mean, it's very difficult for us to defend a leadership like the Iraqi leadership.
But it is the U.S. that have kept it in place with dollars, with intelligence, with armament. And we know that in the Arab world. Why doesn't it put them in jeopardy?
I don't think it's quite accurate to say that the U.S. government kept the Iraqi government in power. I think all of us around the world, we supported the Iraqi government during its war with Iran. And that is something that Arab governments have done based on their national security interests. Iran in the late 70s and most of the 80s poses a direct threat to its neighbor. This is how international politics are, unfortunately. So we all participated in support of the Iraqi regime when it was beneficial to our national security. Now, the equation has changed. Iraq has turned on its own people and its own neighbors. So it's not quite black and white. It's not very clear. It's a mix. And I think the first step in fixing any problem is for us to admit our mistakes and try to help ourselves first before we start accusing governments for doing certain things.
In closing, what would you like to say to the United States people listening to this interview?
I think we all have a responsibility in understanding the consequences of what our governments do. And the U.S. today is a global leader when it comes to democracy and civil rights, and people look towards the U.S. for a lot of guidance on these issues. If we all understand this responsibility and understand that at the very end we're all humans, we share a common human history and heritage, and we all are interlinked some way or another, and try to remember that, it makes us more open to dialogue and to speak with one another.
Prince Bandar bin Khalid Al Faisal Al Saud, the co-founder and trustee of the Arab Thought Foundation, speaking with WPFW's Reem Kathuta. Some of the major organizations and voices in the anti-war movement actively promote anti-capitalist sentiments rooted in communist theory while opposing social injustice. In this piece from the Houston Independent Media Center and Pacific Station KPFT, Honoré Brown and Renee Feltz examine how new people lending their voices to the growing opposition to an attack on Iraq are introduced to these sentiments at mass anti-war demonstrations, such as the nationally coordinated October 6 Not in Our Name protests and the International Coalition to Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, or International Answer mobilizations, on October 26.
1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your oil war. 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your oil war. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I ended up on the bus to D.C. I'm trying to remember how I found out about that. I think I got an email. Or I think I may have actually learned about it through Not in Our Name. Really, the way I've gotten involved with Answer is just because I'm interested in doing something about the impending war on Iraq. And I've actually done a few different protests where different groups were represented. But as far as, what each one believes in, I actually haven't gotten that far. You know, I haven't asked. I haven't been told. I'm just against the war, and I'm going to go to whatever protest I learn about.
That was the voice of Nancy, a young woman from Houston, Texas, who recently attended a local anti-war rally where a diverse range of voices spoke out against an attack on Iraq. She is one of many people in this country who are so concerned about the issues that they've gotten involved with the anti-war movement.
And I think that there's a reality here that since 9/11, what the government is doing is a pretty horrendous thing in the world and here at home. And that needs to be opposed. In that opposition, there are many different visions and ideas of what kind of a future world should look like. But to get there, the first thing we have to do is we have to stop this.
And that was Joe Ergo, member of one of the largest anti-war networks in North America, Not In Our Name. Founded after the attacks of September 11th, the group encourages people to pledge resistance to endless war, detentions, and roundups of immigrants, attacks on civil liberties, and the war in Iraq. On October 6th, thousands of people pledged resistance at massive rallies called by Not In Our Name in New York and San Francisco, and at smaller demonstrations throughout the country. Another group calling for anti-war mobilizations that attracts thousands of people is International Answer. Civil rights lawyer and member of the Answer Steering Committee, Myra Haven Hillard, explains the group's origins.
Answer was formed in the days after September 11th when we saw that the Bush administration was using the horrible attack on the civilians in the United States to push a pre-existing war drive agenda. And there were a number of organizations at that time who had already been planning, organized, and were planning for protests in Washington, D.C. in conjunction with the meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And we all came together to move forward as the Answer Coalition, which is Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, and had a mass demonstration in D.C. on September 29th of last year that had about 25,000 people.
The efforts of groups like Answer and Not In Our Name are part of what has been a fast-growing anti-war movement both in the streets and on the Internet, where much organizing takes place. DualPower.net, a website hosting a mutual aid network of ideas and information for activists and community organizers, is one place where strategies to create positive social change are discussed. Site administrator Dave comments on the anti-war movement.
We're actually in extremely good shape. I mean, when you consider the last major war that was undertaken by the United States against a third world power, something anyways at the scale that we're talking about, probably be Vietnam. And when you look at the opposition, the broad opposition that's already happening right now, I think that we're overall doing very well. If you look at the history of the 60s, people weren't saying these things in 1963, 1964. Very few people were even saying them in 1965. I mean, the scale of resistance that we're already seeing right now puts us around, you know, 66, 67. I mean, it's getting quite widespread even before anything's really happened. So in that sense, it's quite encouraging. I guess there are a few things that concern me.
People like Dave often focus on the anti-war mobilization efforts of Answer and Not In Our Name. One of the main critiques is that Not In Our Name works together with the Revolutionary Communist Party, or RCP, and that the International Action Center, or IAC, is part of the Answer Coalition. The IAC shares some of its members with the Workers' World Party, which endorses Soviet-style communism.
Anybody who's not a member of the International Answer or like of the actual Workers' World Party or of the RCP should really be thinking about, you know, where they stand on these issues. That's the first thing that has to be done. I mean, I can't say for the entire population of the planet, no, you shouldn't work with these people. I mean, that's crazy. But I think that people should be questioning things just a little bit and thinking about, well, where do I stand on relation to these kinds of issues? That's just being aware of it is the first thing.
But people like Mara Haven Hillard stress that criticisms like this may not take into account the coalition structure of groups like Answer.
The Answer Coalition is a coalition of national organizations in the United States, and it includes a number of groups, mine, the Partnership for Civil Justice, the Nicaragua Network, the Free Palestine Alliance, IFCO, Pastors for Peace, the International Action Center, and a number of other organizations. And so we all work together. We have a national steering committee. We have discussions and plans. And also we work with people all around the country in the thousands who are organizing for these events and who are working to build this movement, which makes it extremely powerful. And the International Action Center, as I said, is one of the coalition partners. They've been a really excellent coalition partner. And they have committed enormous amounts of volunteer time to making this movement what it is and to building this movement.
Joe of Not In Our Name offers a similar analysis of the importance of a broad anti-war message, especially as expressed in the group's Pledge of Resistance.
It's when you read the Pledge of Resistance and when you see those slogans, you know, no war in the world, no war in Iraq, no detentions and roundups of immigrants, no police state restrictions, those are the points of unity. It's really based on the politics that are expressed in the statement and in the pledge, and it allows people from many different perspectives to come together, whether they're revolutionary communists or anarchists or religious people. Everybody can read in that Pledge of Resistance and say, gee, that speaks for me. It's informed by these politics that says we need to take a stand with the people of the world, we need to speak loudly and say what this government is doing doesn't speak for me, and we need to call on people to resist. You know, it's a good question. What is this really about?
Both Joe and Haven Hillard of Answer argue any concerns about their group politics are worthy of consideration, but disagree with accusations that they are front groups for the RCP or Workers' World Party. Criticisms have been leveled against these groups for not being upfront about their politics, but Haven Hillard argues that the IAC is prominently featured in Answer's literature and on their website, and that the coalition structure of the group is part of what makes its anti-war message so appealing.
The message that the Answer Coalition is putting forward really does resonate with people, and that's what we hear. I mean, after October 26, we've had thousands of people contacting us who heard the speeches and really appreciated what the different voices had to say. And there were many different viewpoints represented up on the stage on the 26th from many different perspectives, but all united against the war. And that's one position that we all take, is the understanding that we need to come together in a united front to fight this war drive, because that's how it will happen. It won't happen with factionalization and division.
Mm-hmm.
It won't happen with red baiting. And, you know, we really encourage all people who believe in that, who want to fight for a better world and fight for a better direction, to join us. And we think the constructive criticism and dialogue is very healthy for the movement, a sign of maturity, but we will reject any demands for purging or for factionalization. That simply plays right into the hands of the people that would push for war.
Those in the anti-war movement who identify themselves as radical Democrats suggest that they, too, want to stay away from factionalism and infighting. Instead of engaging in red-baiting and finger-pointing, people like Day focus on shortcomings in their own organizations and how to continue building a broad movement against the entire system that supports military actions like an attack on Iraq.
I really get the sense, for some reason, that the forces of the anti-globalization movement, however you want to call it, the anti-corporate globalization movement, the anti-capitalist movement, really hasn't exerted its full influence on the war yet. I find it sort of strange and a little bit interesting that way. I'm not quite sure of the reason of it, but it seems that we haven't really quite found our feet yet. Now, when we do get moving, it's going to be a quite impressive thing to see, I think. The war and the capitalist economy are completely inseparable. I think that the reasons for them are completely inseparable. And just the way that the functioning of the entire system works, it functions as a whole. And if we can link up the anti-war, that is the political elements of the state as it's currently structured right now, which is a warfare state, it depends on aggressive external adventures, it depends on political domination of large areas of the globe. If we can link that political critique up with the economic critique of the anti-democratic corporations that we see running around all over the planet and exploiting people and destroying the environment and all the other things, I think we will really have put together if we can make large people see that connection, we'll really have put together a massive and devastating critique of the system as it stands, and I think that at that point anything can happen.
As political activists sort out how to best complement each other, they all maintain their hopes that people like Nancy will continue to be attracted to the anti-war movement that finds its strength in its unity.
To me, if there are people out there saying we don't want war right now, that's what I'm resonating with, and so I'm probably going to participate in anything that anybody does.
This piece was produced by Honoré Brown of the Houston Independent Media Center and Renee Feltz of KPFT News. For several weeks, independent journalist Jeremy Scahill's reports from Iraq have aired on this program, Democracy Now!, and his website, iraqjournal.org. Today, we present the second part of a speech he gave to students at St. Peter's College in Jersey City, New Jersey, on the topic of Iraq and the dangers of American foreign policy.
In Iraq in 1990, the currency was one of the most valuable in the world. I'm holding a fat roll of Iraqi dinars right now. This currency was extraordinarily valuable. Three American dollars equaled one Iraqi dinar in 1990. Today, it is 1,760 Iraqi dinars to the dollar. I got 66,000 American dollars in my hand right now in 1990. Today, almost nothing, $15. Wages have remained virtually static. Imagine that. Wages have remained virtually static. with the currency going from one of the most valuable in the world to almost worth less than dirt. I had seen videos, pictures, read testimony about the suffering of the Iraqi people under what we call economic sanctions. It's a very copacetic term, sounds very clean. It sounds like an alternative to war. But in the modern era, we need to redefine for the policymakers in Washington what is a war. Because as the foreign minister of Cuba, Roberto Rabina, says, we don't call a war anymore. And what's happening right now to the people of Iraq is in fact a war, whether or not there are bombs falling, because the reality is that before one bomb fell on Iraq in so-called Operation Desert Fox in December of 98, Iraq was a country of unimaginable human suffering. Estimates range between hundreds of thousands all the way up into 1.5 million civilians killed by the U.S.-imposed sanctions on that country. They call them United Nations, but it's really the U.S. agenda manifesting itself under the guise of international cooperation. I saw a child born in the south of the country in Basra, which I spoke about before, the country that was on the receiving end of tons and tons of bombs dropped by the United States, coated with depleted uranium, with nuclear waste. And those bombs were coated with that because they're more potent. And they also coated the bullets that American and British soldiers fired off with depleted uranium, because they can pierce through armor. In some cases, they can pierce through tanks. But they use those at a high cost that continues to happen in Iraq and also in this country. There was a study done last year that took together people from Iraq and Kuwait and Britain and the United States, and most of them from Britain and the United States were soldiers. And what that found was that many of the soldiers in the United States and Britain are experiencing some of the same health problems as people in Iraq. Many attribute that to the use of this nuclear waste coating on these bullets. But today in the newspaper, we read an independent report released by the Pentagon, indicates that exposure to radioactive material used in the Gulf War is unlikely to have caused the health complaints from veterans whose illnesses remain unexplained 8 years after the war. Then you explain why veterans are puking up orange vomit. You explain why children in Iraq, and I saw a 7-day-old kid who was born when I was there and is dead now, born with no mouth, not just a cleft palate, a hole the size of the top of a Pepsi can, and that child shrieked and shrieked and shrieked. And the Iraqi doctor looked at our delegation and he said, plastic surgery is not an option for this child. We're reusing our syringes 5 or 6 times. You go into an Iraqi hospital, you are walking into a death row for infants. Imagine that. There is human waste on the floors of Iraqi hospitals. Children sleep on beds covered with flies. There are kids who are so malnourished that their skin has begun to eat itself. It's brown. It looks like the children are dirty, but they're not. Their skin is eating away at their body for lack of nutrition. You have mothers who have abortions against their choice because they can't sustain their own life, much less the life of another. And with all the rhetoric coming from the Catholic community against abortion, where is the rhetoric that says involuntary abortion is wrong when we impose it on the women of Iraq? I met a woman who found out when she was 8 months pregnant that her child was being born with no brain. No brain. The human catastrophe, there's not a strong enough term to describe what has happened in Iraq. Words fail us. The United States imposes the severest of restrictions on what the Iraqi government can buy. They can't buy pencils because lead could be used to make weapons. They can't buy bleach to purify their water because bleach can be used to manufacture chemical weapons. Well, as a result, the leading cause of death among children are waterborne diseases. Children die from diarrhea. Imagine that. Children die from diarrhea. Malnutrition is rampant. You don't see a chubby person in Iraq who's not a member of the elite presidential guard or a member of Saddam Hussein's inner cabal. You don't see people with pot bellies or chubby. You see skinny, suffering people. And when the campaign started to educate people on the sanctions in Iraq, people in Iraq begged activists, please, we're a proud people, do not take the case of the sanctions this way. Attack it from an international law perspective. Do not humiliate us. Well, 8 years later, the suffering at unimaginable levels, that is what the campaign has had to do, to expose just what the United States is doing. But many are not listening, and the movement is not strong enough, and it needs to be stronger, because this is one of the greatest crimes against humanity in history. The United States aims at the civilian infrastructure, not at military targets. Democracy wouldn't be profitable in Iraq for the United States. Now, some people may disagree with me on that, but give me a moment to explain what I mean. In the case of Nigeria, when you can put, as Chevron and Shell like to do, when you can put a few million dollars in a bank account of a corrupt general and have your way with the indigenous people, that's easier than dealing with a parliament or a Congress or a group of legislators that may have the audacity to think independently of Western powers. When you have to deal with a democratically elected government, it's not as easy to impose your neo-colonial agenda on people in Africa and the Middle East. It's easy to deal with dictators, and that's what the United States wants. In fact, the Central Intelligence Agency doesn't want a democracy in Iraq. They want a change in generals. Saddam Hussein was profitable to American foreign policy interests during the Iran-Iraq war. As Henry Kissinger once flippantly remarked to a group of reporters, wouldn't it be nice if they could kill each other off, Iran and Iraq? The United States backed the government of Saddam Hussein because it was considered a stable, secular regime, certainly more appropriate to American foreign policy interests than an Islamic fundamentalist government. On August 2, 1990, 4 days before the sanctions were imposed on Iraq, and it's fitting they were imposed on Hiroshima Day, 4 days before that, George Bush attempted to sell sensitive military technology to the government in Baghdad. It was stopped by the State Department. August 6th, the United States led the charge to impose the sanctions. By August 9th, George Bush called Saddam Hussein tantamount to Hitler. That's a one-week period.
Independent journalist Jeremy Scahill speaking to students at St. Peter's College in New Jersey. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Rolando Arrieta. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Lona Elias, and Laurel Paget-Seekins. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm the executive producer, Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.